The Tom Woods Show, episode 2077.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am very glad to be joined once again by our old friend, how I describe almost every guest on the Tom Woods Show, Germinal G. Van, who is one of the most prolific people I think I've had on the Tom Woods Show. At age 32, he's just released his 22nd book. He's an award-winning author and independent scholar in the Chicago area. I hope it was okay for me to say that. Is it okay for me to say that?
Yes, of course.
Okay, all right. If anybody's trying to track you down, I just made it slightly easier on them. But we're going to be talking today about your latest book, The Economic Policy of Thomas Jefferson, A Historical Analysis, which features a foreword by somebody my listeners will be familiar with, and namely me. I actually wrote the foreword to this book. Thank you very much for inviting me to do that. It was my pleasure to do it.
Oh, thank you, Tom, for accepting the opportunity, because you're one of the New York Times bestsellers. You're an outstanding historian. So to me, that was an honor. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. As I told you, I said I had kind of a tight schedule. I said I have a very long flight, so I'll write it on the plane. So I did. I wrote it on the plane, and then I sent it to you from the plane. And then I got the response from you that you liked it. What a world we live in. Such a thing is possible, you know? Really crazy. And then, of course, I was joking while I was working on it. By the time I finish this foreword, you'll have another book probably written. So anyway, you've written about quite a diverse range of topics. So I guess I want to ask you, what made you choose this particular one?
So first, I love economic history, and I wanted to write about an American president. And I wanted to focus on their economic policies. I mean, you know, Thomas Jefferson is well known by the public as a founding father. We all know that he was for state rights. He was for limited government. But very few people were aware of his economic policies. Like, why did he ask president? Because some people even don't know that he was president. You know, they just know that he was a political philosopher and a founding father of the U.S., and that's it. But he ruled the U.S. for two terms, so he had the time to actually implement his philosophy, so we can actually judge him on data. And, you know, we have the data to assess what he did. So that's why I wanted to write about it, to see what this guy actually did, because all these philosophical principles that he defended, how did he put that in practice? So that was the thing that attracted my curiosity toward the topic.
You don't confine yourself just to Jefferson's terms as president, because you also talk about his controversy, the controversies that arose between him and Alexander Hamilton, the debates they had over various topics in the 1790s. Mm-hmm. So maybe we ought to start there. I think some listeners will be fairly familiar with the nature of that debate, but let me put a little twist on it and just say this. I think the way many historians and popular chroniclers would describe this is to say that, at least to give the impression that Hamilton was maybe the more sophisticated of the two. I mean, after all, he was chosen to be Secretary of the Treasury, presumably for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so they are inclined to give his opinions more weight when it comes to economic questions. Mm-hmm. Whereas Jefferson, what was he? Some kind of silly agrarian.
Yeah, he was a farm boy.
You know, yeah, right, exactly. Caught in some bygone era and, you know, not prepared for modernity or whatever kind of thing. So they're inclined to dismiss him or not take his point of view seriously. Where do you come down on that between Jefferson and Hamilton?
So when you look at Jefferson and Hamilton, as you say, yes, Hamilton was seen as a more sophisticated person. You know, he was more intellectual, more academic than Thomas Jefferson. But if you go deeper, the comparison is exactly like, you know, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. In the U.S., you have people from all over the country. We have a decentralized system. at least economic decentralized system where people get to pursue their, you know, their happiness, whatever fits their ambitions. And you have people in the Soviet Union who control the economy. And those people were very smart. Like, and you have people like Leonid Kantorovich, who won the Nobel Prize in 1975. Those guys were extremely smart. They had doctorates in mathematics, statistics, and God knows what. And yet their system failed, despite the fact that those guys were sophisticated. And when you look at Jefferson and Hamilton, Hamilton had a very elitist view of society. He was more like an aristocrat. He was like, the best have to rule. And to him, the best were the people who were educated, who had a technical background. He did not trust the common man. He did not trust the average American citizen. He did not believe that the average American citizen was smart enough to understand what he's doing, specifically when it comes to the process of economic development. And Jefferson, on the other hand, was like, well, you don't centralize an economy. Let people do their thing because they know best since they live in that locality. The consumer knows the producer. But when the producer is in Washington and the consumer is somewhere in Ohio, how do you know what the guy in Ohio wants? That's a problem. So Thomas Jefferson was like, well, we have those states. They have their own constitution. They have their own ways of life. So let them live their lives as they see fit. So Thomas Jefferson believed in individual choice, while Alexander Hamilton believed in government making choices for people. So basically, government knows what's best for people than themselves.
So let's extend that now to some of the topics that they covered. So the key ones really involved the assumption of the state debts and the paying of the debt at par rather than discounted. What can you say about these? These seem very obscure issues to most people.
Yeah, so the thing was that Hamilton wanted people with technical background to be able to pay the debt. So it was like merchants and investors from Europe and other high-class people in American society. So technically, the conventional farmer could not afford being part of paying the debt back. And the problem is that, and what Jefferson did not want was that the debt accumulates because it's going to have to fall on the next generations. But Hamilton made a short-term calculated choice. To him, the debt was a political asset. And that was, you know, one of the first origins of Keynesian economics. We're going to spend our way out. The more we spend, the more we're going to create demand. But as we know, this spending is artificial because that money has to come from somewhere. So what does it mean? It means that the average citizen is being taxed because the government has no property on its own, has no money on its own. The government has to get that money from somewhere. So, of course, he has to get it from the taxpayer. So the government kept spending more and more in order to invest in the national infrastructures. But the debt accumulate over time, and the second and third generations were the ones who have to pay for it. And Jefferson disagreed with that because he said the people who took the debt are the ones who have to pay that debt. And having that debt is going to simply be an everlasting problem on the national economy. So one of the first things he wanted to do was to reduce the debt as much as possible. And one of the ways to reduce the debt is to simply shrink the size of government, which is what he did. So that was one of the first philosophical principles that he applied, and it worked.
He also had views on taxation that I think you could say he more or less implemented while he was president too.
Yes, basically, yeah. And so with taxation, what Jefferson did was to have a very frugal approach to government. So as he reduced the size of government, he did not increase the tax rate. So people were able to pay taxes at the same level. So it was kind of like a flat tax pretty much. So, which increased tax revenues for the government. So tax revenues increase and people still had more when it comes to the purchasing power because it did not increase the size of government. So that helped people having more money in their wallet so they can invest, they can buy land. So at the time, since agriculture was the main economic sector where people could create wealth, so people were buying land and they were doing agriculture.
Well, that, of course, brings up another one of the differences between Jefferson and Hamilton, you know, a decade earlier, agriculture and industry. Now, there are plenty of Hamiltonians, including Hamilton himself, who favored various federal benefits and subsidies for manufacturing, let's say. But it's not right to say that both sides were favoring some kind of government policy for their desired vision for America. I mean, yes, obviously Hamilton did have a series of policies that he thought taken together would lend encouragement to industry. But it's not the case that Jefferson said, oh yeah, well, I've got my own package of legislation that'll promote agriculture. I think his view was that if you just step back and let the economy function however it's going to, it's naturally going to move into agriculture, at least for the time being, on a large scale.
Yes, exactly. And the reason why Jefferson was a visionary of his time was because the Industrial Revolution did not come in the United States until the 1820s. So the U.S. was definitely an agricultural society. So Jefferson was willing and ready to for the U.S. to go its own way, to go slow until we are ready financially to afford moving toward a more industrialized economy. Hamilton, on the other hand, was the one who was rushing things. That's the real deal here. He was rushing things. He wanted to industrialize the United States as soon as possible. But it's important to understand that economic development is a process. It's a process that takes time because first the mindsets have to change and people's income have to grow. So the living standard also have to grow accordingly. But when you are investing faster than what the economy is supposed to grow, what it does is that it creates a deficit. And under George Washington's government, the U.S. accumulated a big deficit. And when Jefferson became president, he turned that deficit around. So that was, again, one of his greatest achievements as president of the United States. So what he did was that he was the first U.S. president to truly apply the concept of supply-side economics. But when it comes to free trade, that was a double-edged sword. But I'm sure we will come to that eventually.
Well, I suppose now is as good a time as any. For the most part, it seems as if people favored some level of tariffs, but the issue was, what should that level be? Now, of course, tariffs can get so high that they almost become a qualitatively different thing, because once they reach a certain height, they become protective tariffs, which makes them not really so much a source of revenue as rather a kind of social engineering project to direct consumer behavior away from purchasing foreign goods and toward purchasing domestic goods. That doesn't seem to have been Jefferson's intent. So when you have a modest to lower tariff, it'll have some protective aspect to it, but it'll also generate some revenue for the central government. I don't know that there were a lot of people who wanted no tariff whatsoever. So what is Jefferson's outlook on this?
So the thing with free trade and tariffs here was that, of course, everyone wanted tariffs, but they wanted low tariffs. But the problem is that Jefferson here switched his priorities from economics to foreign policy. And because he wanted here to protect the U.S. name and glory, although the U.S. could not rival with Great Britain at the time, because Great Britain already had experienced the Industrial Revolution, so they were far more advanced than the U.S., he wanted to fight against Great Britain economically. So as he imposed the embargo, now all the goods and services that were supposed to be exported, now people here have to consume them. But since they did not sell those goods and services abroad, they have to raise the price. So as they have to raise the price, it became harder for the average American to afford this. And that reduced people's buying power, and it actually tanked the economy between 1808 and 1809. So that was like the big downfall of Thomas Jefferson. I would not say downfall, but I would say his greatest shortcoming. within his presidency is that he, if he focused on his economic policies rather than foreign policy, he could have managed the embargo to not take the proportion that it did. But his ambition to fight Great Britain with resources that he did not have. And that, unfortunately, tanked the economy for a year or so.
I think both he and then Madison, who succeeds him, and then Madison changed around the, had his own series of policies to punish Britain and France. Mm-hmm. They both overestimated the extent to which those countries were desperate for trade with the U.S.
Exactly.
They really felt like if they imposed this type of policy, they could change policy in those countries. And it just wasn't to be. So what they wound up doing, as so often happens with these supposedly well-intentioned policies, the people who suffered were Americans, was the New England maritime economy and everybody who depended on it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it was the Americans, specifically the common man. It wasn't even like the wealthy, because the wealthy could find a way around things. But the common farmer, you know, who only has his agricultural commodities to live on, like, they couldn't do anything about it. And Jefferson here really miscalculated the judgment of the American people. He felt that the American people would support him for trying to fight an economic war that he couldn't win. And he hurt them in that respect. But at the end of the day, since his presidency had more advantages than shortcoming, Jefferson is remembered as one of the greatest presidents in the history of the U.S. But this embargo was truly a shortcoming in his presidency.
Hey, folks, this episode is sponsored by Skillshare. The online learning community is offering our listeners a one-month free trial. Make 2022 a year of new learning, growth, and connection through creativity with online classes from Skillshare. One membership gets you access to thousands and thousands of fascinating classes on topics including illustration, design, photography, animation, productivity, and more. For you Instagram people, there's Video for Instagram. Tell an engaging story in less than a minute. Or portrait photography, shoot and edit Instagram-worthy shots. I'm not on Instagram, but I'd love to shoot and edit Instagram-worthy shots. And look, whether you're a dabbler or a pro, a hobbyist or a master, you're creative, and that's why Skillshare has classes for every skill level. It's got short lessons, hands-on projects, classes designed for real life. You can tap into that creativity you know is in there. Skillshare helps you move your creative journey forward without putting life on hold. You'll create real projects and get the support of fellow creatives so you can accomplish real growth. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods, where our listeners get a one-month free trial. That's 1 month free at Skillshare.com/woods. Let's skip ahead to I guess it's not really ahead, it's 1803, but the Louisiana Purchase. What is the economic angle here, either causes or consequences?
So the thing with the Louisiana Purchase is that Jefferson wanted to have access to the Caribbean because he wanted to be able to deal with South America as well. That's number one. And number two, the Louisiana Purchase was also part of the westward expansion. So we all know that the United States started on the East Coast all the way to the South, and they were starting to have a shortage of land. So there were more people who demanded land, but there was not enough. So Jefferson believed that the only way to provide these lands to people so that they can take advantage of the opportunities and the promises that America is giving them, let's expand westward. So the Louisiana Purchase was one of those big achievements. And it was Napoleon who sold it, I believe, for $15 million at the time. And then Louisiana was able now to, because it had a port that was connected to the Gulf of Mexico. So trade there could actually take place between Caribbean islands that were still under Spanish control and also Brazil. But the downside of the Louisiana Purchase is that it incentivized slavery, because slavery was still going on in the Caribbean as in Brazil as well. So Louisiana became the place to trade slaves from other countries to the United States. And as you know, like a lot of people found Jefferson to be hypocritical on his stance on slavery, because he claimed that we're all equal before God and before the Creator, and we'll have equal opportunities, but he still owned slaves who were human beings. But what is interesting to understand here is that at this time, slavery was not a moral question. It was an economic system. And slavery occurred for thousands of years. It's not something unique to American culture. So that was the issue. But now with woke culture and everything, people blaming Jefferson for being a racist because he claimed that people should be equal before the law, and yet he owned slaves on his own. But to come back to the Louisiana Purchase, the downside of it was slavery, because Louisiana became the epicenter of the slave trade in the Caribbean.
I was going to ask you about, in talking about economic policy and the economic consequences of Jefferson, how slavery fit into that. I am also, by the way, on the show notes page where I'll have your book linked. That's tomwoods.com/2077. I'm also going to link to a previous episode of this show with historian Kevin Gutzman, who's a biographer of Jefferson, mm-hmm. who had a pretty interesting discussion about this vexed question of Jefferson and slavery. So I'll link to that there. So most of the time when we see Jefferson critiqued over the Louisiana Purchase, he's critiqued for the political aspect or the constitutional aspect, because they say that Jefferson was a strict constructionist of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. He didn't think necessarily it was a home run that he had the power constitutionally mm-hmm. to purchase Louisiana, but his view was, well, I'll go ahead and do it, and if the people really think I violated the Constitution, they could just vote against me next time. I will point out that he was apparently pretty much alone among Republicans in holding that view. Almost all of them believed he did have the constitutional authority to do it. So I was glad to find the Louisiana Purchase in here as something that also had an economic dimension. It's not just the constitutionality. Mm-hmm. And just as the same as the debate over the National Bank, that has a constitutional aspect.
Oh, yeah.
It has an economic aspect. So let's turn to that. Yes. Talk about that controversy.
Yeah, absolutely. The constitutional aspect of the National Bank was very interesting, because the American Constitution was written in a very precise intention. And the precision of that intention is ambiguity. That's the thing here. And because it is ambiguous, so anyone can interpret it pretty much the way he or she wants. And that's the reason why Hamilton won the war on the National Bank. Because in one of the first articles of the Constitution does not explicitly claim that the government cannot create a central bank. The Constitution kind of say that if the government believes that it is necessary for the public welfare, to secure the public welfare, then do so. So Hamilton took advantage of that little phrase to build his entire case as to why we need a national bank in the U.S. And what also worked in his favor was that George Washington was president at the time, and George Washington was the one who had to make the final decision to whether take that to Congress or not, and then Congress is going to approve or disapprove. But since George Washington believed in Hamilton, and for being a sophisticated guy, intellectual, academic, he agreed with Hamilton and decided to take the issue of the National Bank to Congress, and Congress approved it. If the Constitution was written very explicitly, Hamilton would have not won that debate over the creation of the National Bank. Because, of course, in the Constitution, there's nothing that says explicitly that the government of the United States has no right or no legitimacy to create a national bank. But because the Constitution claims that the government has a role to play in providing the social welfare of the American people, Hamilton uses political genius here. I have to admit, that was a political genius move, even though I disagree with his economic philosophy. He used his political genius to outsmart Jefferson and get that bill passed.
What difference does a national bank make, practically speaking, leaving aside the constitutional question? Why does it matter?
Well, the difference is that the central bank is in charge of the money supply. the central bank gets to decide how much money will be in circulation. And based on how much money is in circulation, then the government can decide the level of inflation. The problem is that the central bank is never really independent. And it is, on paper, they say, yeah, it's run its own thing, but it is a political asset to the government. Because the Treasury is here to collect taxes, but the central bank is what actually determines monetary policy. And when you have such institution, in accordance with the government to determine monetary policy, politicians can take advantage of that institution to get their way. So that's why Jefferson was utterly distrustful of the central banks. He wanted each state to have their banks and run their own monetary system. He believed in a truly decentralized system. The more decentralized it is, the better. The more centralized things are, the worse they become, especially at the level of the management, because people will keep making mistakes and they will keep adding more policies to fix the mistakes that they already made. And when we look at the history of the United States, the Federal Reserve has misbehaved mostly than behaved. Like, the monetary policies has created a lot of harm to the American economy. And Jefferson understood that. And the guy was not even an economist. He was just a farm boy and a political philosopher. But he understood that having a central bank like the National Bank, where the people get to decide how much money we will have in the economy, what will be inflation and what will be interest rates, he was like, this is too much power for a small group of individuals. And it was that fear that was unfortunately realized in 1913 when Congress officialized the implementation of the Federal Reserve.
I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this question, but what is your next project going to be?
My next project is going to be controversial. It's going to be controversial, but it has to be done. It's going to be something that is very truthful, something that I will be called names for it, but I think it's necessary for people to read it so that they will finally understand and be awakened. I can tell you the... I can tell you the actual title of the book. It's called...
Yes, tell us. Yeah, I have to know at this point.
It's called Black Culture and Generational Poverty.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, I know. Black Culture and Generational Poverty is a historical, economic, and sociological analysis. So, yeah. So I'm explaining.
Wow.
Yeah, it's I got into history, economics, and sociology. In fact, the book is very, the big aspect is sociological more than even economic or historical.
It just reminded me, what you said reminded me of the very beginning, the intro or the preface or something to a book by Thomas Sowell, one of his more overlooked books, unjustly, called Civil Rights, Rhetoric or Reality. And I just remember him saying at the beginning of that book that he wrote this book out of a stern sense of duty, knowing full well what's going to happen to him. And
yes,
he says, he's talking about this book, mm-hmm. Nothing is more certain than its distortion. He knows exactly what's going to happen to him before it even comes out. And, you know, I've had that happen to me too. I know exactly, you know.
The fun fact is that I wrote a preface similar to Tom Sowell's. I said, I'm expecting liberals and blacks to call me names, but it's okay. If you can bring the data and apply the scientific method as I did to show my case, then you can disprove my point. Until then, please refrain. But, of course, people will not refrain.
Boy, do I wish we lived in that world. Right? I used to think we did.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, this book is really written out of duty. It's a duty for me to do it. And one promise I made was to carry on the work of Thomas Sowell. Because Thomas Sowell is very old. God knows how long he has to live, but...
Yeah.
We can say that the end is near. So I want to continue his work. I want to continue what he did, which means to educate people, to enlighten people about socioeconomic relations. Because this is profound. in American culture. In American culture, race and socioeconomic status are intimately linked. To me, it's like when it comes to an intellectual aspect, it is fascinating how to analyze how like people are, you know, judged, you know, how people make a correlation between their skin color and their income, you know, like if you're black, we assume that you're poor, you're criminal, you're uneducated. And if you're white, you're rich and wealthy, etc. So this is how American society has been structured. People don't really think about it, but that's how people see. And when you see all these policies to, you know, when we say, oh, we want to help black people moving forward, like those policies of pity and self-congratulations, that's what I'm talking about in the book. So I'm expecting a lot of resistance.
Well, I have a couple of recommendations for you of sources in case you haven't looked at them. So we'll talk about that when we, after we're done recording. I remember when Sowell announced that he was ending his newspaper column, I had a genuine sense of loss, a feeling of loss when he did that, because he's written about so many different topics over the years. And I think he's one of the best, not just one of the best thinkers I've encountered, but he's also one of the best writers. His writing is so elegant and beautiful and convincing. And when he is making a point, boy, he can make it devastatingly. And in his books, it's like he's taken a baseball bat to your skull, because he'll make a point and then he's got this piece of evidence and then that one and then that one. And then if you think, well, what about the, yeah, I thought of that, bang, you know, it's just over and over and over. And the footnotes, the references, you just can't even, you don't even know how to address him. And so I think the way he was dealt with in large part was just to ignore him, because I don't think people knew how to take him on. He was a very, very effective one-on-one debater, so you can't do that. Oh, yeah. And when you try to argue with what's in his books, that's very difficult. So just try to pretend he's not there, but that's hard to do because he is there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Tom Sowell he's a special intellectual, and it's really sad that the American public doesn't know him that much. And I think he deserves much attention than what the mainstream media are trying to portray him.
Absolutely.
And as you say, yeah, they ignore him because you can't argue. I mean, whatever statement he makes is backed by evidence. And when you have the evidence backing your arguments, well, there's nothing to argue about. So you have to ignore it and acting like you didn't read or hear what he said.
Yeah. And as I say, nobody wants to debate that guy. And I perfectly understand. Well, mm-hmm. In any case, the book we've been talking about, The Economic Policy of Thomas Jefferson, A Historical Analysis, I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/2077. And Germinal, I'm going to look forward to when that book is out, because doggone it, you and I are going to talk about it and let the chips fall where they may. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for today. Remember, tomorrow's episode is like a weekend homework assignment. You have to listen to it. It's going to be very, very, very important for as many Americans as possible to know the information in tomorrow's episode. As time goes on, that information becomes more and more important to the future of the world. So how about that for a little drama? So you're not going to want to miss episode 2078. Remember, if you're listening on YouTube and you're wondering, gee, I missed a bunch of episodes. That's right, because I don't release them all on YouTube anymore, because they're threatening to remove my channel and stuff like that. So I'm going to need you to start deciding what you want to do here. Because as it is, you missed about 18 episodes and they were pretty darn good. So you can listen. If you insist on using a video platform to consume the episodes, then tomwoods.com/vid will take you to my Odyssey channel. We're getting up on Rumble also, but really it's an audio show. So it really is intended to be listened to on, you can listen on my website, tomwoods.com. You can listen through a podcasting app on your phone. There are many, many of those. I personally use a relatively little-known one called Podcast Republic, but that's how you can be sure you get every single Tom Woods Show episode. So it would be very helpful to me if I knew that at least you had a backup. You can keep on using YouTube if you like, but you at least have a backup for when inevitable gaps appear. So that's all I have to say for today, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.